Good afternoon. You're listening to Curated, a weekly roundup of the who's who and the what's what in the arts and culture scene here in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio's arts and culture reporter. Each week, we'll bring you conversations and stories about notable happenings in our little slice of the world. Today on Curated, we speak with Maurice LeMay as he leaves Aspen Words.
I had access to that, so I played a lot of kind of dark and angry people when I was young.
We hear why the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet and one choreographer have a special relationship.
I connect to his work. Like, I could look at someone else's work, and maybe it's beautiful, maybe it's beautifully crafted and could be very poetic to you, but it doesn't connect to me somehow. And his work always connects to me.
We speak with author Laird Hunt, and we see a new exhibit at the Aspen Art Museum.
I think aggression is totally built into the way these drawings are made. I think that aggression that these drawings tend to have are, if anything, they're an attempt to match, I think, the aggression that's already inherent in the source.
All of that, plus our song of the week, and as always, The Week in the Arts, a quick rundown of the top things to see, hear, and experience this week in the Valley. That's all coming up on Curated from Aspen Public Radio News. Maurice LeMay is stepping down from his position as executive director of Aspen Words. He'll be focusing his efforts on leading the theater program at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction. Theater has always been his passion. Currently, he's directing Theater Aspen's Buyer and Seller. I spoke with him about what theater means to him and his experiences at Aspen Words.
You're leaving Aspen Words, heading on to greener pastures. You'll be teaching...
But drier pastures, drier, anyway.
Drier ones. In still living in Glenwood Springs, right?
For a year, yeah.
For a year, and then you'll be moving to Grand Junction,
I think that's the plan, yeah.
Yeah, to teach theater, which is kind of your true passion.
Yeah, it's what I grew up in and what I have an education around and what I really do love. It's just one of my great joys to be in a rehearsal room and trying to figure out how to tell a good story. I love it.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me about when you first discovered that that was kind of your passion?
You know, I started out, my aunt, who is 7 years older than I am, would come into our living room when I was a little kid, and we'd go down to Florida, and she would play the piano and play the guitar and sing. And I was so taken by her and so mesmerized by her. And then she went on and she did some shows on Broadway, and she was in Pump Boys and Dinettes for years and years. She played it in Chicago and then went and played it in Branson, Missouri. And she and her partner did that show down there for 7 years.
Right.
So I think it was in part her. And then you know, for me, it was also the value of just processing my own stuff as a young person and being able to express myself in ways that I couldn't express myself in my regular life. And
how so?
I'd say, you know, just some of the grief and the anger I had about my own childhood. So, I mean, that sounds kind of funky, but it was that processing of some of that stuff for me when I was younger. And so I thought acting was the way to do it.
And it sounds like kind of it was you finding your people, like you found like all these other introverts who were not at all once they got on stage.
No, that's the funny thing about actors is we think they're these extroverted kind of crazy people. But, you know, it's almost always driven by... either introversion or some trauma or some need to express or whatever it might be, that that actually, if you're actually just with them in private, isn't necessarily there. It's that mask that actually allows people to express themselves in unique ways.
Mm-hmm. And is there something that you weren't able to express, kind of like as you, but then you were able to express as someone else on stage?
Anger. It really was. It was anger. And it's something that I had to learn how to, I had such rage, I had such anger in me. And to learn how to do, I had access to that. So I played a lot of kind of dark and angry people when I was young. And so now, like, I feel like I know that that's there, but it doesn't come out in these weird spaces the way it did when I was a young person. Mm-hmm.
So then you ended up at Aspen Words.
Yeah.
I wonder how literature and theater are similar and different.
Well, they're so similar in terms of what people are aspiring to. When I thought, you know, I kept always apologizing when I was around writers early on because I was like, I don't know, you know, I don't really know much about what you're doing, and I don't, you know, necessarily feel like I know how to help or, you know, even necessarily relate. I felt like a fish out of water. As I've come to know writers and come to spend time talking about what the process is, we're trying to achieve this exactly the same kinds of things. You know, we're looking for that way into someone's life that is different from our own. And I mean, that just fundamental thing of imagining a life that's not our own is what you do in the theater. It's what you're trying to do in fiction. And that, for me, that step into taking the imagined life is such a useful thing.
And how long did it take you to kind of realize that you were trying to achieve the same thing, just in a different way?
Discovered that maybe in my, you know, 20s, that was something that I felt when I was starting out as an actor, that just that immersion in someone else, to actually step aside out of my own constraints, out of my own beliefs, out of my own desires, and take on someone else's, was actually a spiritual journey for me. It had that kind of effect. And the practice of the theater was that practice of staying alive and present to another person on stage. And, you know, in our lives, we're always, you know, we're second guessing. We're thinking about, you know, what I could have done. You're thinking about what you might want to do. In the theater, you have to stay in just the immediacy of the art form is what's so attractive to me.
And then now you're transitioning out of literature and back into the theater world. I wonder if that's a change at all.
Well, it is. You know, I've been working over at Theater Aspen, and you know, you come back. You have a stage manager, you have actors. There's a kind of process that happens that you have to have. There's a structure in that collaboration that it doesn't matter which theater you go to, it's always there. And there's something about that feels like coming home to me a little bit. What a writer has to do all on their own, persisting by themselves. And I am an introvert and I can kind of get that, but I can't, doing it alone is just, I don't know, I couldn't handle it just from a creative standpoint. I love that collaboration.
Yeah, and the show you're working on right now, Byron Seller, is a one-man show.
Yeah, so it's a funny thing that, you know, that, and I feel so much for Jeffrey Correa, who's playing this part, but it's lonely. You know, you're so exposed up there, and I'm just trying to be a good partner to him along the way.
And one final question, what was the highlight of your Aspen Words tenure?
I would have to say, actually, this seems, I mean, maybe this is what all directors say, but I have just the group of people I work with, that I get to work with every day, that staff, they're so delightful, they're so hardworking, they're so insightful, it's just a joy to, it's been a joy to work with them.
All right, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Maurice LeMay.
You're listening to Curated from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. Follow Aspen Public Radio on Twitter or Instagram, or like us on Facebook. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick B. Fort. Alejandro Cerruto is a choreographer. He's currently working with Aspen Santa Fe Ballet on its summer program. He's worked with the company many times. Here's why that keeps happening. Alejandro Cerruto sits on a stool in the practice space of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. He's wiry, with a goatee and thin glasses. The dancers of the company move in front of him. They move together closely. Little Moral Jump isn't a new piece. It's also not the first time Cerruto has watched these same dancers in the same space. The way they move might not be expected by those with a more classical eye.
I like to change sort of the atmosphere in the on stage.
That's Cerruto. He can never focus for too long, he says. He tries to be surprising on stage by the way that he directs his dancers. They tangle through each other and hold each other face to face.
Maybe I give a hint of what I want, but then we all discover together what the final thing is. No, I don't come with a preconceived idea.
The final product Cerruto creates is exactly what led Tom Mosbrucker, one of the founders of the company, to commission him to choreograph a piece.
He was in the studio choreographing it, and I saw the moment. I saw that moment that I was going to remember later.
Last year, Cerruto put together a piece called Silent Ghost for the company. He spent time working in Aspen for a few years now. That's outside of his own work in Chicago. There's something about the way the dancers move in a Cerruto piece, Mosbrucker says. You always have one moment that sticks in your head long after you've left the theater.
I connect to his work. Like, I could look at someone else's work, and maybe it's beautiful, maybe it's beautifully crafted and could be very poetic to you, but it doesn't connect to me somehow. And his work always connects to me.
This week's guest for First Draft is Laird Hunt, author of the novel Never Home. Never Home tells the story of Ash Thompson, an Indiana woman who enlists in the Union Army during the Civil War. To do this, she dresses like a man. In this segment, Hunt explains to First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin how he chose this topic.
So about 18 years ago, my wife, Eleni Sikelianos, who's a poet, who also teaches at the University of Denver, gave me a copy of, for my birthday, of a book called An Uncommon Soldier. And they were this book was the collected letters of Sarah Rosetta Wakeman, who went to war and fought as Lyons Wakeman. So she went in disguise. She disguised herself as a man and served for 2 years. And these were her letters home to her family on a farm in New York State. And I was just absolutely blown away by the content of the letters, which are revealing in some ways and withholding in others. And sometimes she signed them Sarah, sometimes she signed them Lyons. And so the letters themselves were extraordinary. And then there was the preface written by the editor who put it together, a woman named Lauren Cook. And she talked about the fact that there were hundreds of women who did this during the Civil War. So it was this amazing thing, and it really rocked me, sort of knocked me back on my heels. I never heard of it, and the idea of hundreds of people doing this. But there wasn't a story yet. There wasn't, you know, my mind was sort of going off in little directions with it, but nothing real. And so I put it in my pocket and didn't forget it. You know, a decade and a half went by before I actively started to work on it again. And it was when we were coming up on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, which we're still in. And I saw an article in the Times on their disunion blog by Tony Horowitz, the historian and journalist who wrote Confederates in the Attic, which is about the sort of ongoing legacy of the Civil War. And at the end of this article that he wrote in the Times, he makes a remark to the effect that so much remains to be uncovered about the Civil War, and much of what we know about the Civil War is mis-encrusted. And this brought me back to those women and to Sarah Wakeman and to the many others. And I started doing research, and soon after I launched into it, I had the first line of the novel and went roaring off from there.
Do you think there was some myth around women serving, or do you think that was so unknown there wasn't even a myth there?
I think it remains relatively unknown. And having just gone to almost a dozen cities to read from the book and present it, people come up to me left and right to say, well, on the one hand, they congratulate me on inventing this amazing premise. Or they say, wow, I had never heard of it before. And how amazing. Or they say, wow, I heard about this one person, but I thought that there were just a few of them. So it's still relatively unknown territory. And it isn't that people aren't starting to write about it and think about it. It's just it really hasn't been widely disseminated, this information and all these amazing stories about these pretty incredible women.
So when you were reading these historical accounts of women who went to war dressed as men, I'm wondering if you found what some of those motivations were for them and if any of them were similar to one another?
One of the things that was interesting, the more I read in stories about these women and discovered things for myself about them, is that their motivations were varied. And it wasn't simply, as some did, or it wasn't just because their husband went to war and they wanted to be near their husband, or their fiancé went to war and they wanted to be near their fiancé. Some went for friendship because there was another woman who was going to do it. Some went for opportunity. Indeed, Sarah Wakeman was already working as a boatsman and was recruited in her disguise to go off to war with some of her fellow boatsmen. And so she, a big part of her motivation was getting a paycheck and having some kind of opportunity that wasn't locked to the family farm. Some went because they were patriotic. Some went because they wanted to experience an adventure. Some clearly were not comfortable in their own skins and went to experience life that was closer to the way they felt that they should be. And so that there were all kinds of motivations. And what I love, I love it because it reveals a kind of deep humanity about these women. They are as varied as the world is varied. And it was pretty exciting to discover that it wasn't just one thing that took them to war.
When you were inventing your character, who is known throughout the book as Gallant Ash, what sort of qualities were you thinking about for her, and how did she come to you?
She really came to me out of the first line of the book, I was strong and he was not, so it was me went to war to defend the Republic. And once I had that line, it was as if suddenly I could see miles forward into the story and the novel. And so really, she is a creation, a creature of that voice that in many ways possessed me and continues to echo a little too loudly in my head. She's like the unwanted, the unwelcome guest. She sort of has set up residence in my head and won't leave, and I'm trying politely to ask her to leave. And so it was certainly I discovered more and more about her as I wrote, and in the revision process deepened the sense of her character and the people around her.
That was author Laird Hunt, author of Never Home. He spoke with First Draft host Mitzi Rapkin. To hear their entire conversation, go online to aspenpublicradio.org. Thank you. A new exhibit at the Aspen Art Museum talks about protest. One artist in that show is balancing two opposing forces, creation and destruction. Tony Lewis found a book in his mother's bathroom a while ago called Life's Little Instruction Book. It's a self-help book with phrases like, don't major in minor things, and never deprive someone of hope. It might be all they have. When he found the book, he was kind of shocked.
You know, initially it was like, oh, this is a thing that my mom does. She goes to thrift stores and she buys these books, and you know, that are either teacher quotation books or, you know, self-help books about how to be a better person, which is exactly what this book is.
But on further inspection, Lewis found out that the book was a bit darker than it seemed. It inspired him to take bits from the book and put them up on a wall in the form of nails and rubber bands. Graphite is smeared around each letter.
If there's any sort of aggression in here, it's nowhere near the aggression that's in that book already. So it's just anything that's trying to match up to it.
Lewis balances two very different forces in his work, creation and destruction. Another piece is a crumpled pile of paper that takes up a large portion of the floor in one gallery space. At first glance, it just seems to be torn and ripped paper, but actually it's been drawn on. First, large pieces of paper are spread across the floor. Lewis and other people draw and spread graphite all over it. Then it's lifted up, folded, ripped, and abused however he chooses, and basically is dropped where it was.
It kind of begins with sort of a contradictory relationship to the text, to say that the source of the book is something I kind of believe in. It's also something I don't particularly think has any real merit.
Lewis's work is being featured in the Aspen Art Museum's latest show, The Revolution Will Not Be Gray. It aims to talk about revolution and protests through a gray lens, one that isn't black and white. The title poses the question of rebellion, balancing two opposing forces, much like the way Lewis balances his creation and destruction.
I think it has a lot to do with being able to read the language and then deal with the fact that this is over 1,000 screws.
And over 1,000 rubber bands and 1,000 fingerprints, creating art to destroy the meaning of text. For this week's Song of the Week, we've picked one of my favorite singers. This is Drinkin' Whiskey Tonight by Pokey LaFarge.
Drinking whiskey tonight. Go get your buddies and them guys you said you knew. We drinking whiskey tonight. We got the picking for your party of booze. This town's got something we could use. When can you live if not this night? We drinking whiskey tonight. He likes his bourbon with a little bit of water. Well, she likes it, man, with a little bit of soda. He likes, she likes, we like, we all drink together. So come on and pass that stuff around. You can get anything that you want, don't you see? Just come and get it while you're getting good company. Got a girl on my left, got a girl on my right. We drinking whiskey tonight, that's right. Thank you. likes it bourbon with a little bit of water. How she like it? Well, she likes it with a little bit of soda. He likes, she likes, we like, we all drink together. So come on and pass that stuff around. Well, you can get anything that you want, don't you see? Just come and get it while you get in good company. I got a girl on my left, I got a little girl on my right. Yes, man, we drinking whiskey tonight. Ah, we drinking whiskey tonight. That sound good.
This is The Week in the Arts, an abbreviated list of the upcoming events and happenings in the Valley. The Aspen Music Festival and School is holding a dedication of the Buxbaum campus on Monday. Tuesday at the Aspen Institute campus is the McCloskey Speaker Series. Steve Case, the founder of AOL, will be in conversation with Aspen Institute President and CEO Walter Isaacson. Attend a Skype book club meeting at Explore Booksellers on Tuesday. Paper Bird plays in Glenwood Springs on Tuesday. Josh Ritter performs at the Belly Up on Wednesday. Pace Magazine called him one of the best living songwriters. Tom Sachs and Tom Healy lead a discussion about contemporary art at Anderson Ranch in Snowmass on Wednesday and Thursday. Leftover Cuties perform in Snowmass on Thursday. The Carbondale Rodeo is on Thursday. Theater Aspen's Dear Edwina opens on Friday at the Hearst Theater in Rio Grande Park. Puccini's La Boheme is being performed by the Aspen Music Festival on Saturday at the Wheeler Opera House. It's Lemonade Day in the Roaring Fork Valley on Saturday. Kids up and down the valley build their own lemonade stands as part of a national program to teach young people about entrepreneurship. And for a listing of today's major events from the Aspen Music Festival and School, go online to aspenpublicradio.org. This is Curated, a weekly show dedicated to arts and culture. I'm Patrick Ford at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.